Thanks, Angela. Thanks, Kate. It's a great privilege to be here. I should just correct, I didn't actually write 20 books. I've written about half a dozen and I've edited a large number, so I'm not completely obsessive. Maybe I am, but I think to have written 20 books you'd have to be a bit obsessive. You mentioned co-chairing the 2020 summit with Kate Blanchett and Peter Garrett, which was a great thing to do a few years ago. And when I walked into the meeting, the first meeting, the planning meeting that I was invited to, because I was sort of brought in sort of late in the process because Kate was about to have a baby, and they said, "And who are you?" And I said, "I'm here as the understudy for Kate Blanchett, and I'll just try." Well, tonight I'm here as the understudy for The Herd, so I'm quite comfortable in this understudy role, and I'll hope that my comments might help to sort of set the frame for some of this discussion tonight. We were asked to talk about personal experiences in terms of the topic, and I guess I've had some, but I don't want to bore you with them, because they're sort of, the thing with freedom of expression discussions is in general they're about little things which only sort of make sense when you add them up in the whole. But I do recall one little example which I think is actually quite interesting. I mean, it's sort of funny now, but in the early 1980s, I was asked by the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald to write a column about the on-court indiscretions of a tennis star. Now, this was the time when tennis players were in transition from the discreet, well-behaved chaps and chapesses who dressed in white and behaved very properly on the tennis court, to the flamboyance that we came to see with people smashing rackets and wearing fluoro-coloured costumes. It was a very sort of measured sport that was played discreetly. Anyway, it was also the beginning of the new world of sports broadcasting, when mics were introduced onto the field. This was before television soaked up every available minute of every available day, when sports on television was still seen very much as sort of blokes running around and, you know, the commentators telling us what they'd done. So this was the beginning of the opening of the beginning of the period when they started putting mics on the courts. And on this particular day at the Australian Open, the star had hit a ball on the line. It was just on the line, and the umpire had called it out. And the star was absolutely outraged, but in a discreet way, said, "Oh, bugger." Now, bugger's not a word that would even raise an eyebrow these days, but then it was a big issue. The broadcasting authorities considered it a breach of the licence conditions. There were many complaints. Such language was just not acceptable on primetime television. Now, this was only in the early 1980s. It's not that long ago. And I was asked by the editor to write a column about this, you know, to look at the issues of freedom of speech, about changing standards, about the cumbersomeness of regulation, about the way the miking of sports fields was changing what we knew about what was going on in the game. And I wrote what I thought was a pretty witty piece about when a word was unsayable and what was at stake as the technology of the TV of television changed to bring events even closer to what was really going on. I have to say, it was one of the few columns I've written which didn't get published. In this case, the editor explained to me sometime later, and with some embarrassment, that the decision was taken that caution was the better part of valour. He said it was a very funny column and he really liked it and it was a good issue. But after all, Fairfax at the time owned not only the newspaper, but it also owned the television station that broadcast the tennis. And they were just a bit worried that if the broadcasting authority decided to pay too much attention to this little incident, it might lead to questions being asked at the next licence renewal hearing, which was due fairly soon. So they thought that caution was the better part of valour, and it was smarter just to pay me for the column and not publish it. Gosh, I mean, there was a TV licence potentially at stake. Now, and in those days especially, the rivers of gold on TV ran extremely deep. Now, I mention this incident because it seems to me that it illustrates several of the issues that need to be considered when we talk about how, or we consider how free we are. Things change over time. Can you imagine a debate about the use of the word bugger on television now? I mean, it's almost unimaginable. I mean, the language that's used is so much freer. The second point is that technology forces a lot of change. This wouldn't have been an issue, this particular instance of the language of the tennis player, if it hadn't been that there were microphones on the court. And commercial interests are never far away from the resolution of these issues. But in the end, I think it's important to remember that community values prevail in a society like this, and change does happen. The rate of change that has been remarkable in my lifetime, both in terms of the access to information and the tolerance of a wide range of material and the expectation that we can get whatever we want and express a view about it, really without many constraints. The trajectory has been towards very practical steps in this most pragmatic of countries to enhance freedom of expression, which I think is sort of an essential building block in the steps towards what John Keane has described as a monitory democracy, that is, that we're moving towards a democracy in which people expect to be able to oversee, to analyse, to pass judgment and to monitor what's going on in all the bases, all the areas of political power. The Baillieu Library at the University of Melbourne has currently got an exhibition on, which I commend to those of you who are particularly interested in these issues of censorship and freedom of expression. It traces the history of censorship in Australia and displays in glass cases some of the books, many of the books and pamphlets that have been banned, that were once banned in this country, books that are now part of many, many libraries, pamphlets arguing for freedom of political speech that we would think was just anodyne by comparison with the political discussion today. It's worth remembering that this tradition in Australian history, because we do rather like to think of ourselves as a freedom-loving people. You often hear politicians talking about how freedom of speech and freedom of expression is such a central part of the Australian character. In 1962, Peter Coleman, who's probably better known these days as Peter Costello's father-in-law, but once was a real power in the land in his own right, wrote a book about the censorship in Australia, which had occurred up until that point. And he compiled a long list of things that had been banned. I just want to read you a bit. This is a paraphrase, but I'll just read it to you. Over the last 50 years, Australian governments have censored swear words, blasphemy, offence to the monarchy, advocacy of communism, advocacy of anarchism, irreverence to religion, advocacy of political assassination, horror stories, advocacy of witchcraft, birth control information, advocacy of the social benefits of prostitution, advocacy of the social benefits of masturbation, opposition to marriage, advocacy of single-parent childbearing, the belittling or denigration of members of the armed forces, descriptions of lesbian or homosexual behaviour, descriptions of heterosexual sex, material offence to a military ally, and given comfort to an enemy nation. They're just some of the things which have been banned in a sort of public discussion in Australia. It's a pretty remarkable list, but it is in the past. This is a changed society, and change does happen. The history shows that there have been two big movements really in Australia around censorship. There was the first one, I suppose, in the sort of post-war period. I mean, there were some earlier ones, but they're sort of dark history. The first really significant one, I guess, was during the Cold War, which related to the sort of banning of the Communist Party or the attempted ban of the Communist Party and the related sort of surveillance that was very much alive here. I mean, it was strongly alive in other countries, particularly in the United States, but it certainly had social and ramifications in terms of the freedom of expression that occurred in Australia during that period. And then in the big campaigns around censorship are about matters about the way people live their lives, essentially, about sexual and social matters in the 1960s and into the early 1970s. It's interesting that this second wave in the 60s and 70s came about in part because offset printing made it possible for people to print newspapers and print publications in a way that hadn't been so easy to do before. I just mention that because I think that one of the things that you see in this process of freedom of expression and the opening up is that there's a technological thing which is happening in parallel with the sort of social changes. So the bans in the 1960s, which focused on printed matter, on books like Portnoy's Complaint and Ulysses and Lady Chatterley's Lover and many other sexually related books which were regarded as being too sexually risque, provoked intense reactions. Books were smuggled into the country. People were prepared to go to jail to fight the absurdity of banning them. And it went further. Issues went further in the independent and student and underground press. I mean, really around this sort of sexual and social issues. The traditional campaigners in terms of who were used to arguing in terms of political freedom of speech were not really convinced in some cases about extending the freedom to personal and sexual matters. And certainly if you look back at the sort of early developers of the theories of freedom of speech and expression, you don't find a lot of argument about, you know, sexual and personal matters being the issues that are at stake. It's much more about political and social political issues especially. Some even decried this new campaign around this sort of publishing as porno politics, which seemed to be a bit of a stretch. But it was a campaign of its time, and one which ended with a bang when the Whitlam government was elected and changed the laws, stopped banning books, and ushered in a new era in which the personal was very much political. In the intervening years, the terrain really opened up in this country. The High Court found an implied freedom of political expression in a judgment in the 80s. Campaigns against defamation laws really gathered momentum and resulted in recent years in a change to the defamation laws, which have certainly made things easier for writers and journalists. Freedom of information, you know, became a matter that was, became law and opened up a lot of information which had once never been available. So there was a period in which this sort of opening up occurred, sort of slowly and gradually. It was not perfect, but it was certainly a big improvement on that period that I've described to you earlier where so much was being banned. More recently, though, we saw a resurgence of sort of almost old-fashioned political censorship in the wake of the September 11 attacks in the United States. The legislation that was subsequently introduced into Australia was amongst the most extensive in the world. It included provisions to ensure that urging, assisting or glorifying terrorism could be prosecuted. Even the most ardent defenders of freedom of speech rarely extended to supporting such lethal activities. But these were slippery concepts and ones which were open to potential political abuse and which caused great concern. It was interesting in the years when the war on terror was still very much at the front of the public agenda, a number of actions were taken which ostensibly limited freedom of political speech, resulted in 20 organisations being proscribed and really a much more heightened political concern about the damage that could be done by words and expression. As we now know, a number of people are serving long jail terms for planning terrorist acts in Australia, but the symbolism of targeting freedom of expression cannot be underestimated. And certainly there were some people who, during that period when that legislation was being introduced, who saw in the attacks on the prescriptions around freedom of expression an ability for a government to be seen to be doing something while actually not doing anything very much. When this was at its peak, which was about in 2005, 2006, I commissioned Frank Morehouse, who'd been very much involved in the sort of anti-censorship campaigns, both as a young man in the 50s and then more substantially in those sexual campaigns of the 60s and early 70s. I asked him to write a piece about the writer in a time of terror, so during that period of the really strong focus that we had on what might be happening in the war on terror. And Frank was very pleased to take that commission and set about not only rethinking and working back from sort of first principles about the importance of freedom of political expression in a time like that, but also to look at what cases had been occurring. Now, I said at the beginning that the little instances that one has in terms of freedom of expression being limited tend to be small and only make sense in a pattern. And in this particular case, what we came across was between 2004 and 2006, about 20 incidents where there'd been serious action taken against individuals or groups basically around limiting freedom of expression. So there were books that were banned, there were computers that were cleansed, and he wrote in that essay. So what do we have going on here? Security agents arrest a man who sat in a room writing an essay and putting it on the internet. A well-known book and magazine publisher, a university professor and a documentary filmmaker have their computers cleansed by the security services. A man charged with nothing is threatened if he publishes a book that is later published. A radio station has a tape seized. Young demonstrators are threatened under the Sedition Act for protesting. A well-known satirist has his website closed down. Women outside a prison are frightened about saying too much. The government's Security Legislation Review Committee is alarmed that the Attorney General wants to further restrict free speech. Books are banned for the first time since 1973, despite much legal and other advice. And the Attorney General moves the formerly independent censoring agencies into his department. Morehouse concluded, "A country in which people are nervous about saying too much is not the sort of society he wanted to live in." Now, that was only a few years ago, but it's really slipped off the political agenda. It reminds us just how quickly these ideas come and go from the sort of mainstream of the political debate. And it does illustrate how notions of freedom of expression are very much shaped by the current political circumstances. The point about freedom of speech is that it is, as many political and legal philosophers have described, the bedrock freedom, the one which makes sense to who we are and what we are. Without it, no other freedom could survive. It assumes that people can have ideas and opinions and desires separate to those of the church or the state, of the prevailing power or political party, and not be punished for them, that it can lead to the discovery of and the spread of personal and political truths. Of course, there are people who line up to defend freedom of expression when it suits their purposes, because it supports their political agenda, but who, when the power changes, their defence suddenly goes to water. The communists in Russia and elsewhere were not keen on freedom of speech, but their supporters in countries like Australia and America and elsewhere were very keen advocates of the freedom of finding a freedom of speech which included discussion of communist ideas. It's hard to imagine that the Taliban or Al-Qaeda would favour freedom of expression, which was being defended by people here who didn't want to see books banned, which explored some of the teachings and beliefs of the religion that attached to those particular political movements. This does not diminish its importance, but it does mean that those of us who are advocating freedom of speech need to be careful not to become the dupes of others. In recent times in Australia, we have seen the influential campaign by media companies under the banner of the Right to Know to liberalise freedom of information and whistleblowing laws, and they've been quite successful in that, to remove the constraints of the courts on closing matters to public scrutiny. And they were largely successful in many of those changes. Then we also saw the very elaborate and well-supported investigation by Frank Brennan and his committee to provide a framework for a Bill of Rights in Australia. This generated enormous public interest. Submissions were sought from people all over the country in meetings like this, and a well-developed proposal was presented to the government, a proposal which has since been dropped and modified into something which is the shadow of the recommendations of that committee. It was striking that some of the most articulate opposition to the Bill of Rights and the freedoms of speech that would have been embodied in it was the newspaper company most actively involved in the Right to Know campaign. In the new era of monitory democracies, people demand and expect much greater access to information than has ever been available in the past. And I suspect in some ways that as a result of this access to information that comes about through the internet, through the freedom of information, through the presumptions in things like Gov2 that access to information will be available, not closed, that in that environment the press becomes a much less important supervisory agency. Maybe that was part of the reason that they were so vociferous in opposing the recommendations of the Brennan Committee. But it was at odds with this very active campaign that had been run by the papers to advocate a right to know. It was disappointing to see the way the bill disappeared without a trace and without voices in the media or artistic community who had been so loud in advocating freedom of expression some time ago, really making a song and dance about what happened to that proposition. I mean, in my view, it's journalists and artists who need to be at the forefront of defending this freedom. It's their livelihood which depends on it, and artists, more than anyone else in this society, have the space to push and test the limits and provide a platform for change. If it hadn't been for the involvement of writers and artists and journalists in those earlier campaigns, we wouldn't have got the changes that have occurred. So it seems to me that what we're involved in is a process of incremental change, but one where people push forward against the prevailing established viewpoint to create a space for something else to happen. We're in a much, much better position than we have been in the past, but this is not a static terrain. It's one which keeps moving. So that's my warm-up act for the much more interesting show you're going to hear. Thank you.